Southern California Chinese American Oral History Project, jointly sponsored by the UCLA Asian American Studies Center and the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California. This is the tape interview with Mr. Howard Lewis at San Luis Obispo on April 24th, 1982 by Jean Moy and John E.
Yeah, this is John here, just making a tape. So yeah, Toby, I understand that you are the youngest son of the Alui family here in St. Louis Obispo.
Yes, I am the youngest of eight in the family, the five boys and three girls, and I'm the youngest one. There are still seven of us still living.
Oh.
Young, the oldest one, the second one, second oldest would be May. And then there's Walter, George, Ellen, Fred, myself, Howard.
I see. What is your Chinese name?
My Chinese name in Cantonese would be Wong Chun Cho. See, yep, the Wong Chun To.
Wong Chun
To. Wong
Chun To.
Yeah, yeah. So you see, yep, part of it.
Mm-hmm. How about during the your childhood time in St. Louis Obispo? Now, did you, in your family at that time, did you, among your brothers, you spoke Chinese, right?
No, we didn't only spoke Chinese to father.
Is that right?
That's the only time we spoke Chinese at all. So our Chinese was sadly lacking as far as mixing with other Chinese. And plus we went to all American public schools, you see, and all our friends were American.
I mean, at home, when you talk to your brothers and sisters, do you speak their English?
No.
Or did that came later?
Sometimes we had a chop suey English, you know. Mostly English, and we'd, one word we couldn't think of in English, we'd throw the Chinese equivalent in it.
Oh, I see.
I think that most of the American-born Chinese have a little tendency, amongst our older group particularly, to have that chop suey in Chinese, English rather.
I see. At that time, were there very many other Chinese kids about your same age?
Very few.
Very few.
In fact, there are only two large Chinese families in this community. I'm going back up to 1932. Prior to that, there were just the two big families, the Chin. That would be the Chong family and our family. As you probably already know, that our Alui was not his real name.
That's right.
Yeah. We're actually a Lo Wong family.
Yeah. That was
I Do Wong family. Mm-hmm. In southern China, we would be the Dai Do. Some Wak Wong is mostly northerners. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Right.
I find out.
Well, that's in true. This town at that time, we would say, maybe under 20,000. How was you accepted into the community? Was it,
as far as discrimination is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, when you're going to school, do you have any problems?
Well, we didn't have any great problems to speak of, because each one of us, in our age group, we excelled the professions. That is, scholastically and athletics.
Athletics also.
Right. My brother George and I, he was a sprinter, and so was I. And yeah, I think we both held records for a considerable number of years. In fact, I think we still got the record for the 50-yard dash in the local high school, 5.4 tenths seconds.
5.4.
I went from the, I helped to put the high school on the athletic map during the CIF meets in Los Angeles Coliseum. Going from San Luis Obispo, at that time it was 7,000 people, and our little handful of high school athletes went down from here. We're talking about 4 to 6 guys every year we go down and hit the finals of this. CIF meet, which was a state meet, then no thing. And I was pretty small then. Well, George, they didn't have CIF meets when George was going to high school. He graduated from high school in 1917.
Uh-huh.
And he was quite a sprinter. And the state meet, semifinals were held in Santa Barbara, and that's about as far as he got. But I managed to get in the finals.
What year did you graduate? I graduated from high school
in 1947. Anyway, they.
And the school you graduated from was here local.
We all went through the local schools here, and I continued at Berkeley. And my brother Fred, he graduated from the University of Chicago. Being 32. My brother graduated from University of Chicago in 1930. He was a runner-up in the championship and the wrestler. It's the University of Chicago.
Oh, I see. He participated in athletics in college also.
I say my brothers go pretty well.
Did you participate in athletics in college?
I didn't get that up to there because I was too small and I just couldn't afford the time. I did take the offer of wrestling, and I quit when I had a cauliflower ear. I joined the, I used to quite act in football here. In fact, the senior year I was named football captain for high school for the whole year. So at that time, used to have football games in San Francisco between the Chinese and the Japanese. And it was held at Ewing Field there. My brother Walter, he was a jeweler in Chinatown, San Francisco, and he belonged to the Yorkshire Club at that time, and they were looking for a football player, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so they showed him my clippings, the club members up there, of which Tommy Chin used to be play the center. You know, Tommy Chin was one of the first presidents of the Historical Society in San Francisco.
Oh, that's Thomas Chin.
Yeah, Thomas Chin.
Thomas W. Chin.
We were very close friends. So they prevailed upon me to go up and play for their team up there. Every year was a Chinese New Year's game, right? The end of January or February was called the Rice Bowl. It was a big thing up there, and of course the rivalry was quite great.
I want to go back to high school a little bit. When you participated in athletics, you and your brother, naturally, it would seem natural that you participated in the social life on the campus too. Do you feel that you were as American as the others in social activities?
We didn't pursue that too much because in those days of being the only Chinese or Oriental on the campus, probably. There were a couple of Japanese on it. They were always in the background. My brother was brother George. After he left high school, he went became a musician and went on a stage, vaudeville. He had a voice, played the steel guitar. One of the first fellows that I think was the first one that recorded on steel guitar and ukulele solo.
Mm-hmm.
Way back in the 20s and 30s. But as far as having a lot of social activities at high school, we were very reticent about going to those things for fear of maybe, you know, that we didn't want to be embarrassed and we didn't really want to embarrass them. But we were asked to go to a lot of functions, really.
But maybe your family or your father felt that you shouldn't go?
Well, Father, well, he just gave us free rein, really. Oh. He was very good about that. He encouraged us to get out. He always took in all our athletic events. He always made a point to go see a runner play football. Although he didn't understand it, he could tell about the running events that he would be looking for. Maybe that gave him quite an incentive to him. He had a point of 10 or was at his age, but their prime was in the 80s then. I was born when he was about 68 years old. So he was 68. He's quite an active man, you see. Like you said, he's 96. So. But he had a full life until then.
And he was quite active in the store when you knew him, right?
Yeah, oh yes, up until the time I took him back to China in 1932. So. Well, I think I'd like to go back to China. But this is something else about that discrimination point. Most of the Chinese of his age, in those days, well, they didn't want to be buried in America, as you probably know. Because they felt that they were discriminated against and they want to have their remains interred in America. Whereas their relatives, you know how strong their ancestral worship is in China. They said, well, we want to go back to China for the last remaining days. At that time was in 92 then, and they wanted to go back. My brother Fred and I, we just saw this pool and had depression time, you know. I said, gee, what are we going to do? My dad said, gee, I must go back and help China out. So we went back to China, we were full of vim and vigor. But we had changed our sights, because when we saw the poverty in China, because they were really bad. And so we stuck around, and I talked to some of my former classmates at the University of California. I met them at Canton. I said, well, how's things? One was an architect, and one was an engineer that I knew particularly well. This architect said the first thing he got was a big job to design a new theater in Canton. The engineer, he got into water and power over there because his father was a big wheel in it already. But this architect, he said, well, I was making a lot of money at first, he said, but when they found out I was making money, they would put taxes on you any time that they wanted to. And it got to a point, he said, don't even start anything over here in power because they're going to tax you to death any time they find out you're making some money. So I said, well, my mind up.
Was there any difficulty in traveling back and forth?
Yeah, from
here to China?
Oh, my brother and I were American-born citizens, so we had no difficulty there. My father, and Florida, in that time, the Chinese couldn't come and go freely as American. We had to have a passport was no consequence hardly because you were Chinese. We had to have the certificate of identification, and that was a long, drawn process. My father had to sign his name 64 times before my brother and I could get our papers. And we asked the immigration man, I said, well, we already have a passport. He said, that's just one of the six things you guys are going to come up with. It's not as good as the CI certificate of identification. So when we took my father back, father said, well, I'm not coming back to America, so I'm not going to take in any passports. I said, okay. But that's another story there.
Was his intention to take you back to China, to the village, and his intention was to stay? Was his intention to keep the two boys there, or was he going to let you come back to the...
No, he was Americanized and let us have free reign. He said, whatever you want to do, you do. About getting married, you know, the Chinese at our age, most all of them went back, married, started a family, and come back to America to make the money, and then wives to stay back there and raise the kids. That was the thing to do in those days. But my brother and I weren't too Americanized for that. We couldn't.
Your father didn't try to set you up with a
No, we went back to the village where all these Mojian came by and by the tents and so on. Well, we didn't speak too much of it, but I don't think. My brother Fred doesn't speak Chinese degree at all. Because we lost track of that after Dad passed away. And, only time we spoke Chinese was amongst the two dads, between the brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters, and English. So it was straight away. And being our dialect, you know, we couldn't get too far with that.
Right.
In mainland China.
How about the experience that when your dad was back in this village, right? What was his idea after living in the United States for such a long period of time, and then what was his reaction after he got there?
The last trip prior to the 1932 trip was his trip to China in 1886.
Mm-hmm. That's almost 40
and
years.
40, 50 years.
Yeah.
And he said, well, China should be, you know, follow U.S. as far as progress is concerned. And so he said, I want to go back to the village for my people and friends back there.
How old were you at that time?
I see. 22, 24.
So you're still fairly young.
Yeah, 24. And father hadn't been back in 86. So, you know, I want to go back to the village, meet my friend. And he used to come up with Gordon, to build a schoolhouse for the village. And he sent enough money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars over there to put up the schoolhouse in the village. So he felt, well, you know, when he'd get back to the village, he'd be well thought of, which was every Chinese wants to attain their goal anyway. So he went back, we took him back to the village, which is quite an ordeal because of his age. If they jump off the boat there, it's still running. Get off onto a smaller boat and get on to Bungikbao and get on that train to get to the village.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got him back to the village and we had to carry him by sedan chair from the main highway to the village.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a mile inland. It's over the rice field paddies walkway. And we got him back there. Well, the first thing we had to do, all the villagers heard that father's coming back, see? And they said, well, since you're coming back, you should have a baisao, you know, which meant a big deal, big deal. And also, the chance the villagers to meet your new son, your two sons also at the same time, and see what they could have to offer. So that's another story. But for father, that's just the beginning there when we took him back to the village. And we're on it for 10 days and 2 weeks. But that's another long story.
Well, did the villagers expect any kind of gift or presents? Did you have to fellow through that you obligated to bring things to all these people?
Well, father brought home all of his belongings with him, you know, and he was a cigar smoker and a Chinese tobacco smoker. And we had a store, so we brought back about 25 boxes of cigars for him to, you know, smoke or to give away. When we landed in the village, and we had 60 suitcases and trunks full of stuff. Besides what my brother and I had, where he had his stuff along. And these villagers prevailed upon him and put in the baisao, which meant, you know, you got to give away the chopsticks, the rice bowl, and the silk spoon after the guest eats, you know, besides partaking of your food. And when he first got back there, of course, had all these villagers come in and greet him, and he says, where's all my old cronies? Well, there's only one guy back there. He was in his 90s, too, you see. Only guy he recognized or knew, still living. That was the beginning and the end there, because he got to thinking, and he says, Gee, I'm not thinking about it. I got no friends here. And you know, at his age, in China, they don't live. Not very few live that age because of the hardship. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we'll have this baisal. So we had to raise a pilau for that big vacation.
You took care of the store while you were gone.
We relocked the store up. My brother Walter took over. I'm sorry. He came down from San Francisco at the time to take over. Dad went back to China. He held on until he returned to the two brothers and father.
How about this, okay, for this banquet, or this big reception, they built this pilau.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
like a two-story thing.
Mm-hmm.
That took about a week to build. It was pretty fast over there. Made out of bamboo with mat and palm leaf. And, the villages, he invited all the surrounding villages of this Baisal. Mm-hmm. About 1,200 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to dig up chopsticks, rice bowls, and soup to give away. It took a long time to get that together, you know, because the cities around Sanchampa was only Huli, which is about 3 miles away from our village. Then we had to go Sunday to get the balance of it. Then they had to round up all the chickens, many hundred chickens, and so many ducks, and 12 pigs. You know,
12 pigs.
And that's six goats.
Six goats.
Okay. Then they haven't had them. And the Buddhist priest come over and bless all his food, you know. I got picture snapshots of those guys doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I pictures of the pilau. I got some pictures of that.
How long did this banquet last?
Let's see. You know, to feed those guys, we only had to feed so many at a time, see.
Oh.
We could only house so many, like 400 at a time. It took about 3 or 4 days of feeding.
Mm-hmm.
Feasting and cooking at the same time, you had to fill in time because you had no gas to go. And meanwhile, we had a Chinese orchestra going day and night over there.
Mm-hmm.
And had to pay the musicians too.
We had to have posted road guards too, because that was the time of the warlords kidnapping and rampant.
Mm-hmm.
That's further on in the story.
Well, part of the story, I understand that some of the warlords, or what are the bandits, got the whole of the story, right?
Anybody putting on a party for 3 days and nights has got to be in a wealthy, classy figure, see?
Yeah.
So we kidnap these fellows, we're going to get ransom.
Oh. Then what happened then? I mean, did they...
Well, these guards that we had posted on both ends of the town heard that the bandits were going to coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So they warned us about that. So we had just finished that feast, got through with this Moyen bit there, and this word came in. He said, well, I think for your safety's sake, I think you better get back to Canton.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the night before we shoved off there, instead of all of us, the three of us living in this one house where the bandits could capture us and hold all three of us for ransom, we split and each one lived in this, slept in a different home.
I see.
Just in case.
But evidently, did anything happen, or did you get back to Canton safely?
Yes, we did, We caught them. Not the first plane out, but the first boat out. We had to make reservations again on a boat, of course. And after we bade farewell to the people, and we got our things together. We left a lot of it behind because there's no use carting it back here to Canton. And we got back to Canton and stayed in Canton for about 7 or 8 months before we came home.
Oh.
Well, we were there about 10 months.
10 months. Now, getting back into the United States now, you and your brother had the American passport, but at that time you mentioned that your dad, his intention was not to come back to the United States. Did he have any problems?
Yes, my brother and I both had our passport plus a certificate of identification, but Dad didn't have any papers. And that was made it doubly tough. But Chinese were having such a difficult time even getting back legitimately. So we wrote home and told my brother Young, I said, we told him, that was about 6 months over there. I think we better start the wheels rolling because Dad doesn't like me and he wants to come home. Mm-hmm. He said, this is not my home like I thought it would be. My home is actually in San Luis Obispo. Where are my children at?
Now, you said that, okay, your father did not take a re-entry paper back in the United States, so therefore he had some problems to get back, right?
Oh, right. Well, we wrote to my brother Young, and he said, he didn't know what to do, so he heard that the only way to get him back was maybe pull some strings away. So he prevailed upon Mayor Sinsheimer at the time, who's a very close friend of my dad. They both in the general merchandise business, and they both started their straw building construction at the same time. So he called upon him, and he was pretty well to do, and he had a lot of friends in Sacramento. Amongst them was this Senator Hiram Johnson. The mayor asked the senator to do something about it. Senator said, okay, you want to we'll find out what we can do. So he let him know that he would pull strings for my father to get back, but he had to prove that he was a real Alouis. So he cabled to the consulate there in Hong Kong, and the consul sent one of the adjutants up to Canton there to check out my father. And told him, although you can go back to USA now, but you have to first prove that you are the real Alouis, not just a bogus one. So since you were in the general merchandise business, how much is a pound of coffee today? And how much is a pound of sugar today? How much is a bar of Irish soap? How much is a can of tomatoes? And how much is a pound of potatoes? And my father came up with the answers. He said, well, you are the real Alouis. Now I'll give you the okay. You get your tickets, you can go home. You can go home. He was very elated about that. We were worrying what we're going to do with Dad if we had to leave him behind. Had a problem there. We finally made the boat back on the same boat we went over on the first of Cleveland.
And this year was?
In the 32.
Was he glad to get back home? And
yes, he was. Yeah, he was. He was for one for showing elation to us, but that's for the old Chinese. They never jump up and shout for joy, you know. But we could tell that he was very happy about me, smiling all the time. You know, I'm very happy to be able to join my family again. Then we came back to the store. We just let him sit in the store and sit and meet the people coming in. We put him in a chair on the middle of store that way he liked to sit and smoke his long Chinese tobacco pipe, you know, talk to the customers. Yeah. He's up here, a million friends, you know, he never turned away a hungry man. Yeah.
And then at that time, was the store more or less a general store, or is it partly general store and also some gift?
The gift portion was at about 10%. The rest of it was tobacco and groceries.
Oh, groceries.
So that was the time that Piggly Wiggly and Safeway and Purity Stores started putting up in San Luis Obispo. So that after those big supermarkets came in, our neighborhood thing just went down the tube.
So basically, your neighborhood grocery store.
That type of thing, yeah. Well, they're not old neighborhood. We were quite a bit. Had quite a few accounts of the ranchers. They used to come and buy it. They buy on time, you know. I mean, they pay you after the crops are in and out.
Oh.
You get paid at the end of harvest season. You waited 6 or 8 months for your money, but not like today.
Uh-huh. So you did business in bulk also. In other words, you would sell large quantities of, let's say, beans.
Whatever. Oh, that part, that was another. This was a secondary thing, actually, to his farm business. Yeah.
How about the Chinese population, the labor part that used to be in Chinatown? Did it start to decline then? This is in the 30s now.
Yes, it went down here quite rapidly right then. After the railroads were built, most of the Chinese had nothing to do here, so they moved out of here. And the only ones remained were the ones